comes this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? Isn't that fair? Throw it away. All right? All right!
Got tons of popcorn there. Yeah. And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family. From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 180, the Norman Jewison directed, Jimmy Kahn starring, 1975 vehicle, Rollerball.
Yeah, and interesting because as far as Norman Jewison goes, I mean, he's a Toronto director, mm-hmm. proud Canuck like we are, and this would be somewhat of an outlier in his filmmaking oeuvre, because Jewison is not known for sci-fi films or cult classics or anything genre. I mean, he's known for prestige films like, you know, your Fiddler on the Roofs and your Moonstrucks and what have you, prestige movies that garnered lots of Academy Award attention, a lot of critical acclaim. The Hurricane was another one he directed, the biopic starring Denzel Washington. Mm. But as far as making cult classics, as far as making genre pictures, this was sort of like a one and done for him. Now, I say cult classic, and it's interesting because a few weeks ago we discussed Pin. And you start off by saying that was a cult classic. And I sort of took a slight issue to it in the sense that, you know, if a film is underseen, it doesn't automatically make it a cult classic. I said that Pin is a great film, it's an underseen masterpiece. I don't know if it's a cult classic. I don't know if there's a real cult of Pin. This is a minor cult classic. Rollerball, which came out in 75, has, you know, its tendrils have kind of reached into popular culture, general
Metallica aesthetic of the logo and the ball, and
exactly.
The, yeah, it's been...
You were saying
rolled into, cheesy German heavy metal band.
Yeah. And I recall back in the day in university when they would always have those poster sales that would come to campus. Mm. Remember those?
Yes.
And they would have like all these like, you know, dorm room staples, Bob Marley, and, Riz Ordnance,
those are the two right there. You have to have those in your dorm, right?
But you'd be going through it, and you'd be going through the film section, and again, you'd be seeing like, you know, The Clockwork Orange, Blade Runner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there'd always be Rollerball. So Rollerball is a film that is a minor cult classic, so much so that it was remade in 2002, and a very tepidly received remake. I believe that was directed by John McTiernan. I recall seeing it back then. I don't recall anything about it, except for the fact that I remember Paul Heyman from WWF. Well, I think WWF had some involvement in it. Mm. Yeah, I think
What was The Rock in it? Or no, some,
no, no, no. This was The Rock.
Oh, I thought there was some wrestler in it. But
no, Shane McMahon, I think, had a cameo.
Oh.
The star, I mean, if you even remember this guy's name, Chris Klein from The American
from
Pie.
From The American Pie, yeah.
This was supposed to be his first, you know, film, because he was targeted as being like the next big thing, and this was supposed to be his first film away from that franchise. It was going to sort of catapult him into the A-list actor echelon, but Rollerball crashed, and I'm talking about the 2002 Rollerball. But
so he was Jonathan E.
I don't even know. They might have, well, Jonathan E. like character. I think they might have changed the names. I believe LL Cool J was in it. So, of course, you know, there you go. Apparently, it was the production was fraught with a lot of studio meddling. Apparently, the original script was phenomenal, lots of social commentary. But then the studio said, no, we don't want this. We want to take this up, put this in. It was supposed to be a hard R, ended up with it as a PG, et cetera, et cetera. That's Rollerball 2002, a movie that has been relegated to the dustbin of forgottenness, because I don't think anybody remembers that remake very, very fondly, if they do at all. But Rollerball from 1975 still stands tall. Now, this was my first viewing of this particular version of Rollerball. And, of course, as I said before, I've always been aware of the film. Not only because of the iconography, but also because, you know, James Caan, starring in the movie. Anything he would have done in the 70s, you know, in the wake of The Godfather, would have been something worth watching. And I was really excited to watch Rollerball for the first time, and I enjoyed a lot of it, but ultimately it sort of left me feeling just a little bit hollow. It didn't coalesce into something that I could say is, if not a masterpiece, at least, you know, a successful film. There was something about it that left me just a wee bit wanting. And I think I know what it is, but I'd like to, through the course of this discussion, kind of see what you think as well.
Well, yeah, well, I guess to get into it, it's one of those dystopian movies that broadly falls under two categories. One, there's a big calamity and much of the world's population is wiped out. Or two, the government starts to control the populace and there's some totalitarian regime. Rollerball falls into the latter.
So this is even like The Apple.
Yeah, very much so. And war and racial animus is this thing of the past. And corporations have taken over the world.
Yeah.
And the only violence that takes place in this particular culture, which looks a lot like how 70s movies portrayed the future. This is supposed to take place in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
It has an aesthetic that reminds me of Woody Allen's Sleepers. Like, it's white, it's gray, it has that kind of tone. And the populace is enamored, much like Death Race 2000, with this brutal sport.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
This is a bread and circuses, Roman Colosseum type sport that is a hybrid of, I guess you could say, roller derby and football, with
maybe
a little bit of like pinball thrown in, and maybe a little hockey,
maybe a little rugby, a little basketball,
yeah, a little motocross.
A bit of
yeah, it's a one stop shop for every sport.
No, when it comes to post apocalyptic movies, as you said before, you have the, you know, roaming the wastelands sort of Mad Max type movies, or you have the corporate controlled or one world government controlled movies, a la your Death Race 2000, The Apple.
Yeah,
it's
great one.
Hilarious,
yeah.
To put that in that same category. And this one, and so what we're presented here with is what is ostensibly a utopia, in the sense that there's no poverty, there's no war, there's no crime, but the world is controlled by the corporations. There's a lot of illusion. See, the thing about this movie is that it's very much tell, not show. Because they talk about the corporate wars. They talk about the corporations that own the, but rule the world. And they talk about the fact that the public is pacified by viewing this brutal sport, which is sort of like a national thing that everybody watches in order to be entertained. Almost like, even like The Running Man. It sort of has elements of that, where everyone's watching. But a couple things that I find interesting. First of all, you mentioned about the aesthetic of the film, and you mentioned Woody Allen's Sleepers. I was right away, as soon as I pressed play, I was thinking about Clockwork Orange.
Oh, okay, that too. And I was going to say some Fellini elements too, a little bit of weirdness. But
reason for the Clockwork Orange, some of the cold aestheticness of the sets, the whiteness, a lot of the zooms, and the synthesized classical music.
Mm-hmm.
Then I did a little bit of research, and I found out that you was in was directly influenced by A Clockwork Orange, and he wanted this film to be, because in his opinion, he felt that would make the film timeless, not dated. If you would have those white antiseptic sets, what have you, if you are using not contemporary music of the time, but classical music, and all those synthesizer elements to it, that would make the film timeless. This film is a little dated, but so Jewison might have been a bit off on that.
Yeah, track, or tack, or whatever it is. Yeah, I'm just thinking track as they're going around in circles.
On the hypothesis, but so there's the aesthetic, and then the other thing I find interesting about this film, which makes it a different beast in terms of post-apocalyptic. So, okay, this is a utopia, but it's really not a utopia. It's a dystopia, because this is a society where human rights, freedoms, free will, ambition,
are curtailed.
Are squelched.
Yeah.
And are, curtailed.
But although we're not really given a sense of how that's being done.
Exactly.
So you're left to intuit that. And
because this film is a very internal film in the sense that everything sort of takes place indoors, whether it's in these gigantic futuristic office towers, whether it's in the rollerball arena, which is pretty awesome.
And, yeah.
But we don't see much of the life of the general public, the day-to-day, you know, proletariat or whatever you want to say, and how this corporate-controlled society...
Yeah, manifests itself. Yeah, that's a huge debit. I mean...
And, you know, we start the film in Houston, and then... Or was it... No, it was Madrid. Well, no, it was...
Houston versus Madrid,
And then we're going off to Tokyo, and then we're going off to Switzerland, and this regime is global. It's throughout the world. Yet, so that would be really cool to see how this mandated regime works in such disparate places as Houston, Texas,
mm-hmm.
Tokyo, and Geneva, Switzerland, but we don't ever see anything outside of, let's say, the offices and the rollerball ring. Maybe a little bit here and there, you see, like, you know, the outside of Jonathan's ranch or something, but a lot of it is internal, so because we don't really know what's going on outside the rollerball world, so to speak, and all the struggle is told through the eyes of our hero, our protagonist, Jonathan E., played by James Caan, who's a 10-year veteran of the rollerball games. It's hard to empathize with how shitty society may be, because,
you have
frankly,
to take his word for it.
Exactly,
yeah.
And Jonathan E. has got it pretty good. I mean, his biggest struggle is the fact that they're trying to put him out to pasture. They're trying to retire him. But he's, by virtue of being a star rollerball player, he's up there, he's wealthy, he has lots of luxuries, he has he's got his own private helicopter, he's got lavish accommodations, he's got women that they keep sending and taking away from him, these beautiful women, one after another. Yes, he says, oh, at one point they took away my wife, but I mean, a lot of this stuff is told, not shown, and, you know, it's good sometimes, and you don't have to be explicit showing things, but because of this, we don't really get a sense of the real gravitas of the society that this is taking place. The game, the actual rollerball game, yes, there's gravitas there because it is a brutal game. But without the context of the society to juxtapose it to, you don't really get that.
Yeah, you don't get that feeling, and you're only left to speculate, like, why Houston, why Tokyo? Why Tokyo is easier to understand. Corporate culture in Japan... Yeah, very conformist, stifling culture. There's the stereotype of the salaryman who goes on to work on the train every day, goes to the ramen shop, sits cheek by jowl in the same ramen shop and does this routine and kills himself by work, like working for the man. And it's a stifling, anti-individual kind of culture. Fine, I accept that. Houston, why Houston? I'm guessing because of the oil crisis. This company, Energy Corp, is a little bit like maybe an Enron. I don't understand the connection between why Houston, why Madrid. This whole thing, I felt some kind of critical distance from this. Mm-hmm. And we have to take, as you said, like Jonathan E.'s word for it, that society is being held down, but he's having it pretty good, and that's probably intentional. That he's being placated with a kind of soma-type drug from Aldous Huxley. They just feed him all sorts of luxury
to keep him in
his place.
They keep showing people, you know, opening up these little pill boxes and taking a little white pill and taking it.
Mm.
And this, again, so we're...
Like a snuff box from Victorian times or whatever now, yeah.
We're to assume that another way they keep the populace in check, now mind you, where this is the upper
check
classes
from what? Yeah.
That are taking these soma-like pills, and again, you know, so this is an allusion to Aldous Huxley and Brave New World and whatnot, but exactly, we don't know, they don't elucidate, like, what this drug does, how it makes you feel, what the effects are. We don't know if it's only the elite in society, the corporate elite that take it, and so we don't know anything about the day-to-day life of everybody else. In something as ridiculous as the Apple, you know, the Golden Globus musical, we see the people in the factories, in the streets, their daily drills and stuff, and, you know, what was the song again? Bim,
yeah.
So you do not get the contrast of upper versus lower, of rich versus poor, of disparity of the lower class versus the upper class, the bourgeoisie versus the proletariat. So that sort of makes the film a little bit hollow. We have our protagonist, Jonathan E., and he's the one who's going to be the outlier. He's the one that's going to somehow subvert the system from within. However, if the question has arisen, why does he want to subvert the system from within? Why
is
he unhappy?
Is it about him? It doesn't, you don't really get that sense. He wants to get out because it's maybe like he's been a veteran of the sport.
No, but that's the thing. He doesn't want to get out. He's happy. He's happy with the societal structure. He's happy being a well-paid, well-treated veteran of the sport, famous, adored, loved, etc. But as Mr. Bartholomew, played wonderfully by John Houseman, I do like John Houseman quite a bit, says, you know, no man is bigger than the game. And because Jonathan E. is so popular, he's transcending the sport of rollerball, which is, I guess, supposed to be more...
That's the subversive element, I guess. Like if like Muhammad Ali, you know, speaking out against the government, transcending sport by being the most popular athlete in the world. So I guess they're trying to...
Rollerball is supposed to be about the collective, the team, and Jonathan E. is becoming the individual. And again, it's not explicitly even told, but you get the sense they want to get rid of him because he may be inspiring the plebeians, you know, to strive for greatness.
Foment revolution,
strive for greatness, to be an individual, to actually try and be a little bit better than their fellow man. So that's probably why they want to get rid of Jonathan E., and that's the central conflict of this film. If they didn't want to get rid of Jonathan E., if they never said, Jonathan, you're done, you're going to retire after the next game, he would have had no discontent, he would have continued on with his upper class, sort of semi-bourgeois, he's not part of the corporations, but he's just one
level notch
under,
below, yeah.
And he would have continued on in his merry, happy way, but it's a selfish desire to subvert the system because he is being put out to pasture, or at least they want to put him out to pasture.
Well, can't they just end his contract? Like, do they have to go all through all these machinations to really get rid of him? Like, it's not a big deal, right? It is, his term is going to come up, you don't re-sign him, and then like any other sport, he's finished.
Well, I think it's a little more complicated than that.
Yeah, I guess.
We get, from the very beginning, you get the sense that it's, and that's another problem also with Rollerball, is that no other Rollerball character, I mean, there's another Rollerball player, Moonpie, and he gets a few lines of dialogue here and there, and there's a scene where he gets horrendously injured, pretty much killed, brain dead, he might as well be dead.
Yeah.
But we don't learn enough about him to feel any sort of empathy or sympathy. And every other Rollerball player, whether it be somebody who plays for Houston, Madrid, Geneva, Tokyo, they're all just ciphers. They're all just interchangeable fodder.
Hmm.
And
is that by design?
Because
the rest of them are just, they're not exactly seditious, like down with the system revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. They're just functionaries. They're just meatheads going through the motions, enjoying their life, which is a great life.
Well, because as I was saying that, I was sort of thinking about the final scene, and I don't want to spoil too much of the ending, although I will talk about the ending because it's another thing that really rang false with me. But I guess I'm going to have to say spoiler alert. Jonathan E.'s like the last man standing, and he's rolling around the track, and everybody else is either grievously injured or dead. And maybe that was by design, that we were not meant to empathize with these players. They're just cannon fodder for the masses, the bread and circuses, just like the gladiators that, you know, were interchangeable slaves that they would pick up and say, hey, you're out there. So I don't know. But again, returning to my original point, the only person that, I mean, this is basically a man versus man tale. It's a two-man tale. It's Mr. Bartholomew, the head of the Energy Corporation, John Houseman, versus Jonathan E., rollerball champion extraordinaire, Jimmy Kahn, and that's the end of that.
It is a stupid game. It is violent, but it serves a social purpose. How's that for a John Houseman?
Ooh, I don't know.
No?
I think Jerry Seinfeld did a much better. Alec Buh. Such a John Houseman name. Alec Buh. Yeah. It's interesting because John Houseman, I mostly know from...
from parodies of John Houseman.
Or seeing him actually introduce Masterpiece Theater.
Yeah.
And he's so genteel and he's so...
He's American, but he's got that mid-Atlantic accent.
Really
that
he's like
is, yeah.
Price in the same
yeah,
way.
Yeah.
That
was a sign of the times when people would adopt this tone of their voice. And
well,
very strange.
So this was the first time I ever actually saw Jonathan Houseman play a villain. And yeah, he had the... there was something quite nefarious about him and he was able to... kind of, you know, he had that boo-hiss quality. So he was effective. Would you consider James Caan as Jonathan E. to be a hero? that to be an effective hero?
Only insofar as you can't read anything into him, so he's a blank slate,
totally.
The spaghetti westerns type thing.
Yeah.
Insofar as you can't read much into Clint Eastwood either. He doesn't say much. He doesn't.
He's laconic.
Yeah.
He never emotes. His acting is, I would say, somewhat sedated in this film.
Yeah.
I mean, most of what he does is on the rollerball track, but when he's not on there, he's a pretty boring guy. I would say.
For sure. Yeah. Just maybe channeling a little bit of a Tom Jones hairstyle, which I could not get out of my mind. I know. Everyone looked like Tom Jones at the time, but yeah, there's just something about it. He was almost not. It's unkind to say he was going through the motions because it implies it's pejorative. But he kind of was in a way. He's just sort of wandering through, just taking things in. And
well, he was no hot-headed Sonny from The Godfather.
No.
Yeah.
So as things progress, you have, like I said earlier, there's no racial animus, but maybe there was little cracks in the foundation of what this game is supposed to achieve, because at one point, Moon Pie, very disparagingly, when they're training to do battle against Tokyo, calls them pygmy Orientals, and he says we shouldn't be afraid of them because they're so small, and I thought that was a little bit weird, too. So, like, I guess regardless of whether there's no, I guess, democracy and everything's run by corporations, there still is a little bit of tribalism seeping through. It was very weird and didn't sit well, considering, like, the rollerball team from Houston was a racially mixed team where they all got along, and that didn't, it was a strange bit of xenophobia.
I think that xenophobia and tribalism only existed within the rollerball teams, again, not the public.
Again, within one another.
Because even in, when they're playing in Tokyo, and Tokyo has a home field advantage, and they're using some sort of like... when we first meet the Tokyo players, they could not have been dressed more stereotypically. This is not on the track, but we see them in like some sort of airport or press conference or something. And I don't. Can you describe what they look like? I kind of forget, but they remind me of a gang in the Warriors.
Oh yeah, for sure. And they're all trained in Hapkido and karate.
Yeah.
So all the stereotypes
all the
come through.
Yeah,
and they're all like they work really as a team, and they really squelch individualism, and they all work together in sync with almost like a choreographed the skating together and all that. It's very, very pinpoint.
But the thing is, even when Houston is playing, that's a team, of course, that Jonathan captains, is playing Tokyo in Tokyo, and this is, I believe, the semifinals, the crowd is cheering for Jonathan E.
Yeah. There seems to be no animus in the crowd. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not going fighting each other. They're just... It seems fairly placid. It's a decent atmosphere. They're calling for blood, maybe, but there's no battle in the crowd.
It's all taking place
on the track.
You have fans from Houston, I guess, who flew in to watch the game, and you have the hometown boosters, and there's no animus in there. And yes, they're cheering for Tokyo, but whenever Jonathan Yee starts breaking out and kicking ass,
talk about a name that you cannot chant. I just want to say the word velodrome, because that's what cyclists, like in the Olympics, they go around in circles in the velodrome, which sounds so cool. And then when I found out it was about for cyclists, I was like, that's not cool at all. But anyway, they're in a kind of velodrome. They're chanting, Jonathan, Jonathan, which you can't chant that.
Well,
it's weird.
Did.
Oh, I did, but it didn't, I don't know, that didn't, and he,
three syllables,
and it's not a name that you can chant. It really isn't, and him, in doing a physical role, I didn't really buy as well. He's not an imposing guy, and I looked him up today. He's maybe like 5'9", 5'10".
Talk about James Caan?
Yeah, which is why it's funny when you mention Chris Klein, who's like a big kind of brutish football player guy. I can't picture him as the leader of this. I guess there is some guile and speed that's part of this game. It's not all brawn and
buff,
but he's not intimidating.
The thing about James Caan and his intimidating nature, and he does have it, because you cannot tell me that Sonny Corleone was not intimidating. It's more in his persona as opposed to his physical appearance. I recently saw a movie called Lady in a Cage, starring Olivia de Havilland. I watched it because it was referenced in the show Feud, which I binge-watched, the feud between
Joan Crawford
and Betty Davis.
Yeah.
And it was one of James Caan's first roles, and he played the chief antagonist. And it was a pretty intense film for the 60s. It was pretty much a home invasion film. And he played the ringleader of this gang, and he was threatening, and he was intimidating, and he was pretty much psychotic. Physically imposing? No. But threatening? Yes. He was channeling Marlon Brando when he was performing this role. That was something he's acknowledged. But he is intimidating. you buy him in The Godfather when he's laying beats down, but as a sports figure, as somebody who's the best of the best, so to speak, in his respective athletic competition, maybe not. But who would they have cast instead? O.J. Simpson?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
It was the 70s, you know? Okay, so we're talking a lot about the debits of Rollerball as far as it being a post-apocalyptic film, a film that should have some social commentary about corporations and control and freedom and the limits of what the general populace can and can't do based upon some sort of higher power, free will versus determination, and what have you. In those respects, the film, in my opinion, falls flat. However, what really works, and it takes up a good third of the film, if not more, is the rollerball competition. I think, thank God this film was made in the 70s, when these effects were done practically, these stunts were done practically. People were literally putting their lives on the line, because this was a brutal, visceral competition. So, can you describe the sport just a little bit?
Well, I neglected to mention amongst the hybrid bouillabaisse of sports that are included is baseball, because there is one member of each team who's got a glove.
Catcher's mitt,
and he's got a catcher's mitt, so they shoot this ball pinball style, and it's a giant metal ball, almost like the bauble in the Phantasm movies in a way, without the knives. But it's a heavy ball, and it gets shot out, and then the point of this game is to take the ball and, much like in football, like score a touchdown by getting it past a certain point and getting it into like a hole, whatever.
Really, like a cylindrical sort of.
It's like hockey in a way too. But and this, when they're doing the practice session where the Jonathan E is explaining some of the finer points of the sport, like he shows the ball and he drops it and you can see how heavy it is. And when they shoot this thing out of a cannon, like it's not like it takes a certain amount of skill to catch it. And then as you're trying to maneuver this thing around the track, you have to do it so many times before you score, people are bearing down on you on their skates or on a motorbike to try and take you out, and they have gloves with spikes attached to them, and there's a varying set of rules, and the whole point of sports is it has to be confined by rules,
right?
And that's keep changing them extemporaneously.
That's another controversy that happens because we're getting down to the semifinals and the finals, and when they go to Tokyo to play, it's okay, now we're going to change the rules a bit.
No substitutions.
And what was the other rule that they wanted to change as well? Penalties.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty much all bets were off. Well, when a player went down and he was lying there on the track injured, he was not taken off the track for quite a while. So he'd be run over by a motorcycle. Or you just have players set on fire. There was a lot of visceral brutality in the rollerball sport. And as much as I should say, well, no, this is reprehensible. If rollerball was a real sport, I would watch it.
Yeah,
it's pretty damn.
I did watch it growing up because it was a very, very, minor player in the sports entertainment milieu, because wrestling dominated and doesn't to the same extent it did, but it was a very minor player as competition to wrestling, and that is roller derby, and it's sort of they don't.
There's no ball. There's no scoring. It's scoring by
going around the track. Yeah.
You score points by passing players on the opposing team.
Yeah.
So, and roller derby is still around. I mean, it's, you know, there's tons of work.
It's come to life a little bit as a sort of a hipster kind of cachet, as a weird. Kind of like Librador, Lucha Libre wrestling, bowling kind of thing. It has certain things. They have teams, they're tattooed, they go around the track.
But rollerball and roller derby are two different beasts altogether. Mm-hmm. I think the only thing they really have in common is the fact that certain players are on skates and are going around the I'm saying if rollerball was was a sport. I mean, and it's funny too because, and we've talked this many times on the podcast, where they're, I guess, using social commentary by saying, look how violent this sport is, look where society is heading, where they won't be satisfied until they see such brutality for their entertainment. They're going to be so bloodthirsty, and yet you always bring up UFC, which is something that nowadays people watch, and that is basically a human cockfight, and it's people watching it out for blood.
Even that has been confined to strictures of rules because it couldn't fly in the way it previously did when it first emerged, I want to say 15 years ago, because they allowed headbutts and groin kicks, and you would not believe what they allowed. So they had to codify it and put it in some kind of box to make it palatable. So
now, hold on, to make it palatable, because I think a lot of people pine for the glory days of UFC when it was much. When I remember seeing footage on YouTube of some of the grisliest UFC accidents, and I would see like bones popping out of skin.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that would never make a state athletic commission
give it the
green light.
That's what I'm saying.
And
they
can't.
Have to
there's no artistry it. To give it, getting an elbow to the face.
Exactly.
Like,
to make it more palatable, or is it so they can actually get clearance to actually put on these big UFC competitions at, let's say, Madison Square Garden versus somebody's backyard or something.
Oh, yeah, and it's a perfect point of discussion for this movie, too, because in the beginning, it's not as violent as it eventually degenerates into. It is violent, and it comes with the territory that you throw elbows and you run people off the track, but as the rules of the game disintegrate, and there's a scene toward the end where the flames come up and like, there's just carnage on the track as the motorbikes have exploded. It's almost like a Book of Revelations, Lake of Fire, showing like this society degenerating. And it really does degenerate because the rules are progressively chipped away at, and pretty much anything goes toward the end. And there's the high body count, whereas previously it would just be a severe injury. And as things go, his teammates get brutally injured, all the competitors get brutally injured.
Well, it's not just his teammates, it's everybody.
Everyone. I guess as they're in the throes of whatever, the final stages of this empire start to crumble, you see it expressed on the track. So, bread and circuses, Rome starts to fall before your eyes as Bartholomew tries to get rid of this upstart and tries to take him out through whatever means necessary.
That kind of reminds me a bit of No Holds Barred. Where the Machiavellian villain is there watching everything, his grand scheme fall apart as the
hero usurps him. Yeah.
Exactly. But, anyway, but the other thing that I didn't like about this movie was the fact that the ending was very cool in the sense that this was the rollerball game to end all rollerball games. And we did say earlier, we said spoiler alert, Jothany is the last man standing, and he's the one that they want to... that's transcending the game, that's bigger than the game. He's the one that the powers that be want to push out of the game because they're afraid he might inspire some sort of revolutionary fervor in the audience. But this was the 70s, and as we've discussed with good buddy Scott many a time in the horror space, but also in other films, the 70s were famous for, if nothing more than, the films of the 70s were famous for many things, but one of them was downbeat endings. And I was expecting to see a downbeat ending. The ending was downbeat. The ending was brutal. But the fate of our protagonist, our hero...
was not how
was
we
cheesy.
Thought it would be. Yeah,
it was absolutely cheesy. Mm-hmm. And it just, as far as I'm concerned, it belied the tone of the rest of the entire film.
Oh, agreed.
It was just this weird sort of like triumphant shot that you would expect to see in like a Bad News Bears film. Didn't work.
Yeah, that it betrayed its sports film pedigree there when it didn't for the rest of it. Yeah, and then that's a typical Rudy, the natural kind of sports movie ending. It's like, bleh. So, what did we learn from Rollerball? I can start.
Yes, please.
I think this type of corporate influence is wonderful as a starting point for satire. When you think about like Apple Corporation, multi-billion, they might even be a trillion-dollar company soon, the first ever. They wield hugely outsized influence. They are, if they were a country themselves, they would be one of the top economies in the world. So this is interesting stuff to base your movie on, but we don't know how, like, again, in the Apple, how the populace is being affected. So
unlike the Apple, in that cheesy Golden Globus musical, we actually know how the populace is being affected.
Who would have thought? And so they keep talking about... in this movie, there's the futility of individual effort. Fine.
Which is Orwellian.
It's Orwellian. It's like, okay, fine. It's like some, like a Cuban dictatorship or North Korea or something. So you're stifled. But how are you stifled? Because you still enjoy yourself with everything that the creature comforts of a free market economy. All these people are enjoying themselves immensely. So how are they stifled?
The only time we see the plebes, once again, or when they're watching a rollerball.
Yeah, and we both said we would love to be there, and you know, and so okay, we count us among those plebes. Like tough life. I'm sorry, like they're not being oppressed, and I want to see that.
Well, they maybe are, but the film is not successful in conveying that to the viewer. So that's what it lacks, is that real juxtaposition between the oppressors versus the oppressed.
For sure. Yeah. So what did you learn then?
Not a lot. I mean, I think I mentioned a lot of what I learned in terms of my criticisms of the film. The only thing that, and maybe again, like as I'm talking about this, it's a commentary, but it just made me laugh a little bit when I'm watching some of the viewers in the stands and they're cheering, and some of them are wearing t-shirts, and instead of saying, you know, the name of the team that they're supporting, the t-shirt just says Rollerball.
Yeah,
and it made me laugh because
NHL,
exactly.
NBA,
exactly. Unless it's like
FIFA,
unless it's back in the day, you know, like ECW, you would never go to a football game, the Super Bowl, and see a spectator wearing a shirt that says football.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it kind of reminded me of maybe like Homer Simpson that we put on a flag that said like basketball on it. That's it. It just gave me a small chuckle, and yeah, I think that. Any fond remembrance of this film, the reason why it did become a bit iconographic, a bit, you know, how it did sort of maybe get transcend into popular culture so on, is because of the sport. It was just a damn fine, brutal sport that was shot, choreographed, executed amazingly. Mm-hmm. It looked like, I'm watching, I was flinching, I was like, holy fuck, it's violent. But everything surrounding the sport, the stories, it fell through. There's a whole subplot where Jonathan Yee was going to this place to talk to some sort of computer made of amniotic fluid to find information about the corporation.
Yeah,
and it was very confusing as far as I was concerned. I didn't really get what was going on there.
Yeah, a proto internet thing with this weird fluid, and he was asking questions of it. Like it was an oracle essentially, and even this all-knowing piece of technology would refuse him answers, mm-hmm. and he couldn't get the answers he was looking to, i.e., how do these corporations make their decisions? So, but that would have been great to know.
There's a lot we didn't know. We didn't know if this soma-like drug was being taken by everybody or just the elite. We didn't know what the effects are. We don't know how the corporate wars began. We don't really know how the populace is divided. They say there's no poverty. Is it a communist system? How do they make a living? Are they given their weekly, monthly provisions? We don't know anything. All we know is
rapid
that there's
fire questions.
That
I don't have an answer to
visceral, brutal sport that they like to watch. But we also had that in Death Race 2000, and Death Race 2000 had so much more
verve and more life and just more spirit. Mm-hmm. You almost had like Norman Jewison making a genre film with all this artifice. Like it was like these big issues. Like I wanted to make this film, but I wanted to make this didactic thing where you must think. And the other film, the Paul Bertel film, is like, you don't have to think, but yeah, it's the opposite, but you do think, and you end up thinking more in Death Race 2000 and enjoying it more. And this one,
they're making a genre film that's going to deliver all the cheap thrills and nudity, the violence, etc. And you're going to watch it just for the sort of the puerile nature of it all, maybe, let's say.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
But then, subversively, it will make you think. Whereas this is Jewison, I guess, and we want to make something prestige, didactic. This will make you think. This will be profound, and ultimately it falls flat.
For sure.
Which is interesting because it's not a complete failure. I cannot say it was a terrible movie. I actually enjoyed it for most of its two-hour runtime. I love watching the sport.
I enjoyed the aesthetics of Energy Corp's headquarters and office. Mr. Bartholomew's office has these shards of glass that are almost like wind chimes. And Jonathan comes to a meeting with him where he's supposed to be given his walking papers and convinced to retire. And he cuts his finger on one of these decorative elements. And I thought, this is so cool and so weird. It had almost a Conan the Barbarian kind of feel where he's in the mirrors. Mm-hmm. And, like, that was weird and cool. The music's awesome, like the Bach thing, like like the Bach fugue.
Although derivative of the Clockwork Orange, but still.
Yeah, but still, that was really cool, and the game was awesome, so it has lots of interesting elements.
And Bartholomew's an interesting character. Come, Jonathan, join me in some quiet time.
Yeah.
When he walked in, he was in some sort of weird meditation ritual. I don't know. It was lots of very interesting, like, this was a almost like you're cooking a dish, and all the ingredients were just top notch. You know, you had the finest ingredients, the finest spices, the finest cuts of meat. But then when everything goes into the pot and it gets put on the plate, the flavor of the main dish does not live up to the ingredients that were put into it.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
So with that analogy, I'm going to say that my star rating is a begrudging 3 stars.
Yeah, likewise, I'll maybe give it 2 3/4. Criminal over length as well, with just weird, seemingly out of nowhere vignettes. There's this horseback kind of montage where you get a sense of some of the populace likes to go fire guns at trees. Made no sense. Like, I don't know who they were, why they were doing this. It was Fellini-esque. Like, is this another way they get their rocks off? Like, it didn't fit, although
almost
it was cool to watch.
Like,
it was
neat. With, like, the, you know, the screech charm of the bourgeoisie or whatever.
Yeah,
know,
yeah, it was, but it didn't fit cohesively. So it was, okay, fun, interesting visuals, but for what and to what end? It didn't further my understanding of who these people were and what they were being subjected to. Yeah, 2 3/4, 3-star begrudgingly for me, too. Worth watching. For more, check out our website, www.reallyawfulmovies.com. Follow us on Twitter, awful_movies. If you have a favorite dystopian film you'd like us to delve into, reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com. Let us know. And new episodes every Friday. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.